Welcome to the latest episode of the DebtWired podcast. I'm Adam Samoon, Head of High Yield at DebtWire Europe, and I'm pleased to be joined by James Hogarth of Pivotal Point. Pivotal Point is an opportunistic long-short credit fund founded by Kunal Shah last year. Welcome, James. Great to have you on board.
Thanks for having me on, Adam.
It's a pleasure. And let's get started on this podcast on the automotive sector. Why, James, is the auto sector so interesting for long-short credit funds currently?
To begin to answer that, I think probably start by saying the sector's been going through a fairly prolonged period of intense structural transformation, and it's also been coupled with periods of cyclical volatility that have really culminated in uncertainty for the sector being elevated. And because of that, a number of market participants have passed over the sector. It's generally unloved. And that's actually presented some pretty interesting sort of risk-adjusted opportunities for those that are willing to be a little bit contrarian, maybe challenge some of the consensual wisdom of certainly sort of the pre-COVID era. The sector is interesting, at least to us at Pivotal Point, for three main themes, really. The first one is sort of the structural CapEx cycle for the EV transition that the sector's been going through for many years and will continue to go through. You've got sort of the lingering supply chain issues that are sort of further complicated by trade tariffs and global conflict. And then you've got the macroeconomic headwinds, which ultimately have manifested as inflation and higher interest rates have followed. And we've ultimately found ourselves in a structurally higher cost of capital world. And this is coming after a prolonged period of cheap capital that led to over-levered balance sheets. At Pivotal Point, our process focuses on cash flow and legal analysis, and it's been effective in highlighting good businesses that have navigated the uncertainty of the recent sort of 12 months or so. But it's also been good at highlighting to us companies that operationally are good businesses, but are just saddled with bad capital structures, and the solutions that are required need to be a little bit more creative. It's worth also remembering that auto issuers, so both the OEMs and the suppliers collectively, equate to about 9.5% of the pan-European high-yield market, which means that it's a large percentage of the market to ignore, and it ultimately warrants the time of investors to try and understand some of these important sectoral themes.
Looking forward, James, what challenges are impacting and transforming the auto sector?
I expect a lot of listeners would immediately sort of discuss tariffs here. I think I would sort of focus initially on the structural challenges of both the EV transition and the lower production volumes that we're seeing in Europe. Now, tariffs will feed into both of these, and I'm sure we'll discuss later. The first challenge is the EV transition and the investment strain. So Europe is ultimately pushing towards EVs, and it's put pressure on European OEMs and suppliers on multiple fronts, the first of which is regulatory. There will be, in 2035, a ban on the sale of new internal combustion engines. And that's forced the OEMs to basically spend more on the R&D of battery electric vehicles. And as those vehicles are coming to production, it ultimately leads to a duplication of operating costs as well. So sort of second under the regulatory bucket, you have this average fleet emissions fines, which adds sort of a direct financial burden on the OEMs. They're left between either paying the fines for non-compliance or they need to go buy carbon credits. And the fines are based actually on actual sales, and hence sort of a lack of demand for EVs that's not balanced with supply is a hit for the OEMs, both on terms of the fines that they have to pay, but also the associated operating costs. And actually, ASEA, so the European car industry body, has estimated that if you look at the total cost of the potential fines, cost of the associated carbon credits, and then the sale of the EVs at a loss, which the OEMs have to suffer, that collective cost is around about 16 billion euros if the fines were not delayed. And just to contextualize that, sort of the operating profit for all European OEMs in 2023 was around 85 billion. And the estimates for 2024 is that that operating profit is lower, sort of in the low 70 billion range, which means that the regulatory burden placed on the sector is round about sort of 20% of the total sector's operating profit. Now, we are starting to see the regulatory environment ease, but that's really sort of a whole other conversation. I think within this first challenge of the EV transition, the The second part of it is then the higher cost of production of electric vehicles. So the technology is ultimately relatively nascent. The manufacturing footprint isn't built out as much as it is for internal combustion engines. And ultimately, you're looking at higher unit production prices for electric vehicles. And that negatively impacts consumer decisions. So with that sort of downward pressure on demand from consumers, OEMs are sort of left looking at their EV programs really underperforming. And they've ultimately led to the programs either being scaled back or in some cases delayed. And it's the delays sort of in the EV platforms and the subsequent investment that risks really the future competitiveness of European OEMs, especially as we start to see sort of Chinese EV makers sort of enter Europe pretty aggressively, with really the inherent advantages in battery technology because of China's sort of dominance in the supply chain of battery tech. So all in all, you put all that together and you're creating an increasingly competitive market and a financial burden on the sector. I think the second challenge, as I mentioned before, this structurally lower volume environment for Europe is certainly evident within the data. So European light vehicle production remains 20% below pre-COVID levels. Production remains lower than 2019 for a few reasons. If you go back to COVID in 2020 and the lockdown that followed through to 2022, you're ultimately looking at a number of supply shocks, which manifested partly as the semiconductor shortage. Now, OEMs in response to this prioritized higher margin models over volumes, and suppliers kind of scaled back in response. And we saw a number of them go bankrupt, a number of them restructured, others kind of shut down assets. And that capacity that was lost sort of post-COVID through the lockdowns just hasn't returned. Sort of linked to this then, and also the tightening CO2 emission targets, OEMs have rationalized product portfolios. So what they've done is they've removed lower price point, lower margin, smaller combustion engine platforms, just because they were going to be uneconomical to continue to sell. And that also has negatively impacted volumes at a structural level. And then sort of the final point to this is that European OEMs, in order to compete with increasing competition from Chinese OEMs, have moved production out of Europe to try and take advantage of lower labor costs, lower energy costs, and then are looking to export those units sort of back into the continent. So although supply chain bottlenecks have certainly eased, OEMs and suppliers are still restructuring operations to adjust to this structurally lower volume environment.
And we touched on it earlier, James. What is your view on tariffs?
Tariffs are undoubtedly very negative for the sector. The automotive industry is one that significantly embraced and benefited from globalization trend. Supply chains cross multiple international borders multiple times. It's incredibly complicated, and that's before you even really start discussing sort of rules of origin and how that's calculated. If you want to think about tariffs in the context of the European Union, you have to go back to October last year when they placed on Chinese-made EVs sort of tariffs that were as high as 35%, and that's on top of the existing sort of 10% import duty. Now, there remains associated with those tariffs, outstanding legal challenges. There's still the risk of retaliatory tariffs, but ultimately the view is that there should be a deal that will come, and the construct of that is unknown as to whether that's going to be sort of flat minimum prices for Chinese EVs imported into the continent or whether there's going to be a reduced tariff for other concessions. We will have to wait and see. Fast forwarding then to March 2025, US obviously implemented its 25% tariff on European and global auto imports. Today, we find ourselves in an ongoing sort of trade negotiation between the US and the EU during this sort of 90-day reprieve that is set to end sort of early July. OEMs have responded in many different ways. The focus for tariffs really needs to be around the uncertainty that they create, because it's the uncertainty that clouds kind of any long-term strategic decision-making for the OEMs and their suppliers, particularly when they're thinking about their manufacturing footprints. Tariffs are not good in the short term ultimately, but it's the prolonged uncertainty and volatility of a tariff regime in the future that has the potential to do more lasting damage.
Thanks, James. And it would be great to get your insight on what auto sector credits and thematic trades offer investors opportunities currently.
We should start with the suppliers, maybe then we'll go on to a couple of OEMs, and then we'll finish up on the market. When speaking about the suppliers, I think we first again have to go back to COVID. And the reason for that is that this is where you saw a bit of a paradigm shift. In this period, you saw pricing power really move from the OEMs to the suppliers. The OEMs had built up record order books, and suppliers that were ultimately reliable and enabled the OEMs to monetize those order books were fairly successful actually in extracting sort of financial support from the OEMs. And that was in the form of inflationary cost pass-throughs for both direct and indirect costs, better payment terms, but perhaps more importantly was the insertion of indexation into contracts that was just not industry standard prior to the pandemic. This paradigm shift and this increased certainty that suppliers have in terms of future cost pass-through is just in direct contradiction to the reality of pre-COVID. When thinking about the suppliers within this new paradigm, I think you have to look for opportunities in terms of those that are benefiting from a few of the structural trends that are ongoing in the market. So where are those? The first area is obviously any supplier that is supplying a part that is not reliant on a particular drivetrain. So something that's drivetrain agnostic. There's the added benefit as well that if the product's drivetrain agnostic, but they're benefiting from another sort of structural tailwinds, you know, in generally an increased size of vehicle, an increased focus on lightness or economy, those have proven to be fairly interesting opportunities. You also, related to that, you have hybrid vehicles, and they are obviously running two different drivetrains. That creates tailwinds for suppliers that can sell content into a vehicle for both of those drivetrains. I'm thinking, you know, suppliers that are in thermal management, are in actuators, protective casings, even wiring looms. The sort of third area or point of discussion on suppliers is diversification. So diversification for suppliers is generally reported on an OEM and a geographical basis. But diversification actually across different platforms within those individual OEMs, which generally leads to greater geographical diversification, has actually helped certain suppliers be incredibly resilient, you know, over the last 12 months. Even though, in terms of their OEM level diversification, they may not look any better than their competitors. And when I talk about this, I'm thinking about Adler Pelzer. So Adler Pelzer was able to meet their 2024 guidance. They've also been able to keep their 2025 outlook unchanged, and that outlook calls for both top line and EBITDA growth. And part of the reason for this resilience is just the diversification that they have across all of the platforms that they service across the OEMs. And then just a final point on the suppliers. I think you have to ultimately look for the innovators. You have to look for the innovators that have good market share and those that have a low risk of insourcing by the OEMs. Product innovations that came in post-COVID within this new paradigm are now starting to come into production, and they're positively impacting financial margins. And those suppliers that are truly innovating, the commentary from them today is that new order book wins are again at increasingly higher margins, and you'll start to see the benefit of those new order wins in the next 18 to 24 months. I'm talking about Adler Pelzer, in that you look at sort of the sequential margin improvement that they've had in recent quarters and recent years. And, you know, more recently, you know, their EBITDA margin has kind of breached and held above 10%. They have seen sort of the benefit of this paradigm shift post-COVID and from the CapEx spend and the fact that they've been able to innovate. Those are the suppliers. I think if we want to talk on a couple of topical OEMs, we should probably discuss JLR, so Jaguar Land Rover and Aston Martin. JLR, it's really been a remarkable turnaround story since 2018 when it was dealing with the change in the China import duties, and then obviously COVID disruptions and emissions fines, and more recently US trade tariffs have impacted it. But despite all of this, the company's back to a net cash position. It's taken out significant cost out of the business, such that cash flow break even for them in terms of unit volume kind of fell from 400,000 units down to 300,000 units. And it's fractionally higher than that now because of inflation. But in the context of everything that's going on in the sector, they launched a completely new core product portfolio at materially higher prices, and they didn't see their volumes decline, and they've achieved record revenue and record profitability. So even, you know, what was a formerly distressed OEM that doesn't benefit from the size of the majors, you know, has ultimately been able to recover at a time where the investment requirement put on it has been incredibly, incredibly high. And that's ultimately because they've got the right product portfolio. Now, going forward, the company's going to have higher CapEx requirements for its future EV models that will come through shortly. The outlook for this year is certainly more downbeat. They're talking about slightly lower EBIT margins. Cash flow is going to be break even. The reason for that is mainly sort of the US tariff impact. Even this morning, they're dealing with a fire at one of their facilities. But the JLR story and the success that they've had really since 2018, it nicely illustrates this push-pull between the need for both short-term profitability, but also longer-term investment for success in the future. And they've been able to successfully navigate that to date. As to what the next 12 months brings, we will have to wait and see, but it's definitely been a success story. Aston Martin, somewhat in contrast to JLR, is an OEM that continues to search for stabilization. So it remains very reliant on equity support to cover persistent cash burn. It has incredibly high CapEx requirements that are not currently covered by EBITDA. And that's before we even start talking about the exceptionally high interest burden that the company currently has. 2024 was especially challenging. They had some supply chain issues. They saw weakened demand in China, which all culminated in the company burning of over £390 million and the expectation of positive free cash flow pushed out until 2027. Now, more recently, they've announced cost-saving measures, more equity's gone into the business, they've sold the F1 stake, but investors need to really watch the volumes that the company can achieve in terms of its core portfolio. I think what will be key is kind of the sales of the aging DBX 707 SUV that's been on sale since 2022. The deliveries of the Valhalla mid-engine special car will be important in terms of their margins for this year. And then beyond that, it's really about what the future product releases are. But really, all of this is secondary to requiring continued support from reference shareholders. I guess finally, just to move on from OEMs and just finish on some market considerations, we're going to continue to watch primary markets for the sector. We need to see how the market is receptive to issuers from the automotive sector, and we need to see how those deals trade in secondary. We'll continue to watch sort of regulatory developments, EV registration data. We will, of course, need to keep an eye on Chinese OEMs coming into Europe and increased competition, and what a potential sort of tariff deal with the European Union looks like. And then, of course, in July, we should have incremental knowledge around what the US trade tariff regime will look like and what sort of future macroeconomic developments through the rest of the year may potentially look like. So I think the final message from me would be that not all auto credits are equal. You do need to focus on company-specific fundamentals. You need to look for companies that are benefiting from sectoral tailwinds and are sheltered from at least some of the headwinds. And that's what we're going to continue to do at Pivotal Point.
Lots for us to consider here, James. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Adam.
And thank you to the audience for listening. More episodes of the DebtWired podcast are available on Apple and Spotify.